Hey, science fans, now you can have all of the Real Science Friday shows on MP3 CD from 2007, 2008, or 2009. Hear Bob and Fred present the compelling scientific evidence that the Earth is young and that there is a creator. Real Science Friday 2007, 2008, and 2009 are each available by calling 1-800-8-NYART. Or you can get the MP3 CDs or the MP3 downloads at kgovstore.com.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Tonight, Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship will have an event at 7 o'clock. I'll be there with my family, our friends. Please come on out, Wadsworth and 21st, to hear a talk entitled, Why Mathematics Works. Have you ever wondered about the physical universe? Some atheists are materialists. They think the only thing that exists is matter. And energy and matter in motion. But if that's true, how about the whole realm of ideas and logic and math? Well, there is a book out titled Mathematics, Is God Silent? By James Nichol. And what an honor to have Mr. Nichol in studio. James, welcome to Real Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Why do mathematics work? Could you tell me?
Well, that's a question that has been a conundrum to a host of scientists, mathematicians, philosophers for ages. Why does mathematics work? In fact, it can be encapsulated in Albert Einstein's statement from the 1930s when he said, "The eternal mystery of the world is its comprehensibility."
Is that we could understand it?
Yeah. There is an intelligibility about the world that he could not account for based upon his presuppositional starting point, which was God was not a personal God to him.
He didn't believe in a personal God. He believed in Spinoza's God, I think he said.
Sort of a pantheistic view.
Right, yeah. So that God somehow is sort of like nature.
Right.
Nature fundamentally is inanimate, like the whole universe, atoms and molecules. Mm-hmm. And atoms and molecules, they don't have ideas or thoughts. So Einstein said that he could not understand. For everything he did understand, he's one of the most brilliant people that is known to history. But he couldn't understand why it was that he could understand the universe.
And so the word mystery appears in his statement, and it appears in a host of other philosophers. In fact, I've got quotes about the word being spooky.
Spooky.
It's spooky. Here's a quote from Marcus du Sautoy. He's an Oxford mathematician. He says this, the bizarre, well, he uses the word bizarre instead of spooky. The bizarre thing is that the more abstract and difficult mathematics becomes, the more it seems to have application in the real world.
Wow.
And he calls that bizarre.
Well, it does seem to be bizarre to me if you don't recognize that the universe is the product of the mind of God.
Right.
Because when Einstein comes out with his famous equation, E equals MC squared, and then we have so many actual experiments, and then in human history, we have even atomic weapons that show that he was right. We could estimate the amount of energy released from an atomic explosion because Einstein was right. But how could it be such a beautiful and simple equation relating mass and the speed of light to the amount of energy? It's too perfect. It shouldn't be that perfect.
Right. These equations are simple to understand. The foundation was like Newton's universal law of gravitation. It's really easy to follow. Mm. Kepler's laws are very, very simple and easy to understand. But these reflect, in terms of their law, what they reflect of the law order of the universe, a wisdom, a rationality, an intelligibility that is beyond man. In fact, Maxwell's equations, that he developed on the electromagnetism. Mm-hmm. Heinrich Hertz, who actually discovered electromagnetic waves, said that these equations speak more to us, give more to us than we give into them. There's something that they're telling us.
That they're telling
about
us.
About the intelligibility of the universe that is far beyond man's comprehension to account for unless that man submits to the biblical revelation of a creator God. Mm. He's lost without it.
Now, Einstein didn't just make one comment to this effect at one point in his life. If anyone would like to see some of his related quotes and links to their original sources in his writings, I'll give them a shortcut.
Sure.
They could go to AmericanRightToLife.org, a pro-life website, a Bible-based personhood ministry, and just add /Einstein to the domain name when they're on the website, AmericanRTL.org/Einstein, and they'll see that over a period of 25 years, Einstein wrestled with this concept even of ideas themselves.
Right.
And he said, it's a gulf logically unbridgeable. How can you get from matter to ideas? And ideas like reason and the laws of logic and mathematics, because these things are not made up of matter. And so if you're a materialist and you think the only thing that exists is matter, well, then you can't even justify using logic.
Correct.
Logic has no basis, no fundamental validity or justification.
Correct.
If you're a materialist.
Yeah, here's a quote from John Sullivan, a philosopher. He says, why the external should obey the laws of logic, why, in fact, science could be possible, is not an easy question to answer.
And it's not an easy question if you discount the personal creator,
right,
God.
All these men are rejecting the doctrine of creation. And so what they have to replace it is naturalism, or as you've been saying, materialism. Mm-hmm. But that can't account for the connection between the human mind, what goes on inside our brains, and what goes on outside of our brains.
The realm of ideas.
Yes.
And the realm of ideas is where we find notions like truth.
Right.
And morality.
And love and all these issues that...
Love.
Yeah.
Even hate, bitterness, envy. And so all these things that are so fundamental to what it is to be a human being, we find much of the scientific world in basic denial and trying to find materialistic foundations for these things, like nobility,
right,
and righteousness. And there is no foundation in atoms and molecules for righteousness.
Right.
Wow. There's a book I read years ago called The Soul of Science.
Yes, Nancy Piercy's.
Piercy and Thaxton. Mm-hmm. And what a brilliant book. And you reminded me of that because it was in Christianized Europe where modern science really was birthed.
Correct.
And why would that be?
Because out of the ancient Greeks were basically, most historians look to science and math back to the ancient Greeks. But you have to look at why science did not flourish and really blossom in the ancient Greek culture. A lot of science was done. A lot of good mathematics was done. But in terms of...
It was stillborn.
I think it was stillborn. Yeah.
But why would you think that is?
Because of a faulty theology in terms of the nature of who God is and the nature of God's creation. So they tended to be pantheistic. They tended to look at time in cycles.
Circular.
Not in a linear pattern.
Not linear.
The Roman Catholic historian Stanley L. Yockey has written some tremendous books on the history of science, and the word stillbirths was basically invented by him.
Oh, I did not know that. God entering human history through the incarnation,
right,
where the creator God becomes flesh, actually becomes a man, and then lives a perfect sinless life and dies on the cross for us to pay for our sin, is raised from the dead. That doesn't happen over and over and over,
no,
as the book of Hebrews says, once. And so time is not circular. Time is linear. Mm-hmm. We know that entropy increases based on the direction of the arrow of time. There's also another reason why I think science was stillborn, going back to Plato and Aristotle. And this is one of my issues that I like to point out, that when people talk about the Earth-centered solar system, geocentrism, they never really blame Plato. And that cracks me up. Plato and Aristotle, that was their cosmology.
Correct.
And Plato had this view of the Earth in the center, and I think he had 8 spheres around it with the planets and the sun and the moon and the stars, and that they were all turned by the fates.
Right.
That fate is what moved everything. The fates were the ultimate movers. And he never gets blamed for that. I mean, almost never do you read that Plato was one of the earliest to propose this cosmology. And that cosmology held astronomy back for over 1,000 years.
Correct.
It was stillborn because it didn't make sense. It didn't work.
And the key with the Greek view of the terrestrial motion versus celestial motion, there are 2 different laws that govern that. With the incarnation, we have Christ, as John chapter 1, verse 1 says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and all things were made through the Word, the Logos. Well, that was the Greeks understood what Logos was.
Hmm.
It was a rational order in the universe. And the Apostle John said the rational order in the universe
is a person.
Jesus Christ, the person.
Is Jesus Christ.
Yes. And that started the ball rolling in terms of a change of thinking.
Hmm.
It took the creation seen in deifying overtones, it took that away from it. But then creation is also made by Christ, sustained by Christ. J.B. Phillips says in his paraphrase of Colossians 1, Christ is the first and upholding principle of the whole scheme of creation.
Mm.
As that began to infiltrate through the Western world, as our creeds were developed, it took time for this to happen. The belief system held by the time of the late 12th, 13th, 14th century is that God was rational. He made a rational creation. We can take the creation and pick it apart and look at it and put it back together again, figure out how it works, and develop laws from that. That's totally foreign to the Greek concept. You couldn't really mess with creation. You heard the phrase, you don't mess with Mother Nature.
Yeah, right.
That's where it comes from.
Well, my so father, God, could whoop your Mother
yes.
Nature. Anyway.
So experimentation was really not in the vogue in the ancient Greeks.
Aristotle and the idea that the planets had to move in perfect circles because it was the ideal, the form. It had to be perfect. So it didn't matter what you observed. It just had to be that way.
Right.
And Jesus Christ said something so utterly opposite to that about himself. He said, and we have this in a Christian answer to Euthyphro's dilemma. I don't know if you recall that from Socrates, an argument against righteousness coming from God. And it's such an honor that Jonathan Sarfati wrote an article on Euthyphro's dilemma that atheists use. And he put a link to our answer to that at our website, a Christian answer to Euthyphro's dilemma. And Jesus said, if I testify concerning myself, my testimony is not credible. This is in John, the Gospel of John. He said, but look at the other witnesses. Look at the evidence. And it reminds me also of you need multiple frames of reference. You need the Trinity, the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses to know whether something is true or false. Well, to Aristotle, they just had to move in circles. It didn't matter what the evidence showed.
Correct.
They just had to. So the reason there was a persecution against Galileo and these guys was because they were breaking from Aristotle, not that they were breaking from the Bible.
Right.
That was irrelevant.
Right. Right. And that was a major breakthrough because Kepler confirmed Copernicus's ideas by taking the data that Tycho Brahe had painstakingly collected over periods of 20 to 30 years and was able to fit a model to the data.
To the data.
Yeah, and see the wonderful harmony of the way God works the motion of the planets. And Kepler is such a wonderful man to study because when you read his works, you'll see his equations and he'll have to stop and give a psalm of praise to God.
He'll praise God. Didn't he say something like geometry is obviously the product of the mind of God?
Yeah, he was really keen on geometry as reflective of how God orders the cosmos.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And he's the one who came up with the 3 laws of planetary motion, which are the basis of modern astronomy today.
Correct.
And he pointed out that the planets move in an ellipse around the sun, and the sun is in one of the foci.
Right.
So he sees this and he says, we can comprehend this because we're made in God's image, and it's the thoughts of God that put this into motion.
Correct.
So many of the fathers of the physical sciences believed in the creator God of the Bible.
And even the new atheists like Richard Dawkins, they have to acknowledge that. They do that without pleasure.
Yeah, begrudgingly.
Yeah.
Because for a time, and I think it started with Voltaire, there was a revisionist history that Christianity was
in conflict
with science. It was a deterrent to the development of modern science. And now even the secular historians say, no, that's not true at all. Modern science was birthed by men who had a passionate belief in the God of the Bible.
Right.
How about Isaac Newton? We've talked about Newton, but would you say that he was making an effort to affirm the truth of the Bible?
His overall thrust was to show that from his work, to show the system of the world that reflected on the wisdom of the Creator. So that was his goal, was to drive men to their knees in worship.
And worship the Creator God of the Bible.
Yes.
He wrote more, I believe he wrote
more
about theology and the history of the Bible, the history recorded in the Bible, than he did about physics or cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of his major works is written to show that the history of the ancient kingdoms recorded in the Bible is more accurate than the secular history that people defer to.
Right.
And that's, I mean, Isaac Newton is one of the most brilliant men.
What's so brilliant about Newton is he was able to deductively prove Kepler's laws that Kepler was able to empirically discover.
Mm.
So you have this wonderful interplay of induction, empiricism, Kepler, with Newton deductively confirming everything. And I'll talk about a little bit about that tonight, how the confirmation of his inverse square law, a reference to the moon falling.
Mm.
And so that'll be in our discussion tonight.
We have a family with five kids who came from Montana, Great Falls, Montana, to visit us at Denver Bible Church. And they're planning on bringing their homeschool family, bringing their kids tonight. So we said, well, we'll bring our kids.
Tell them to bring their algebra with them.
let me ask you this question. And these are sharp kids, homeschool kids. But let me ask you this. Your presentation, will it be difficult for children? Of what age might they be able to follow?
I'm going to be giving a lot of quotes and analysis of quotes from, you know, scientists and mathematicians and following through a logic of things. And I'm going to give some mathematical demonstrations.
Mm.
The first few, all that you'll require to know is some high school algebra and geometry to follow.
Hmm.
But I'm going to be moving on to Maxwell's equations. I won't explain them, but I'll show them.
Right.
And, of course, that would tax most people's intelligence as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about some other 20th century scientists who use mathematics to actually discover some aspects of empirical reality just through mathematics.
Mm.
And so that would be discussed but not talked about in detail.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be a challenging experience for whoever is there.
James Nickel, what an honor to speak with you. Your book is Mathematics, Is God Silent? Could you tell me a bit about the book, when it came out, how it's doing as far as influencing people, and then about yourself also and what brought you to this ministry?
Okay, the book was first published in 1991, I believe, the first edition. It was a small hardback.
20 years ago.
And I was able to enhance it and revise it into a 430-page compilation that was published in 2001, mm-hmm. second edition.
Mm-hmm.
And it covers basically the history of mathematics.
Mm.
I start with creation, the creation of Adam, move up through the Greeks, to the Incarnation, cover the details of the Middle Ages, up to the Scientific Revolution, follow through the mathematical developments, 18th, 19th, and 20th century.
Wow.
And end up with a conclusion. I have a concluding chapter on why does mathematics work, which is what my talk is going to be summarizing tonight.
Do you talk about zero?
Yes.
Yeah, and when zero
yes.
was introduced mm-hmm. in human thought.
Where algebra came from, where the word come from,
mm-hmm.
and what you get from the book. If, for example, you're taking a course in geometry or trigonometry, Well, you can go back into the index and look that up, and you'll see where these branches of mathematics were first developed. Who developed them? Why did they do that? What's the context for it? Mm. And then there's a worldview thrust analysis behind all this. And so it brings a holistic approach to your study of mathematics.
So as Albert Einstein admits, this whole topic is incomprehensible. It makes no sense. We can't justify it, but it works.
Right.
But we can't justify it because he didn't know that there was a personal God who made us. All he had to do was take that step, and his greatest mystery would have been answered.
Yeah, it's resolvable. But it's resolvable only in a biblical Christian worldview.
Yeah. And so even in a, say, a Far Eastern mystical pantheistic view that there is a creator and there is no creator, all the contradictions of Eastern mysticism, it's not answered in that view. It's not that all you need is a religion and then you could answer these
questions.
It's
a specific set of doctrines that you have to embrace and commit to. To be able to justify doing science and doing mathematics.
Like Vishnu created everything and Vishnu created nothing, and the universe is Maya, it's illusion. And like you said earlier, time is circular. That's all irrational.
Right.
So there are hundreds of millions of people that are trapped in an irrational worldview, which is a great tragedy. And the answer is Jesus Christ. He's not only a religious teacher. He said that he is the truth.
And he holds and sustains every aspect of creation. So behind the power of mathematics and the wisdom revealed by mathematics, there is a person. All the mathematical equations are pointing to, it's like a faint commentary on the living word who's sustaining all things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my passion, is to teach that.
So your book, could you give us an idea of, I noticed, for example, that Vision Forum offers your books. It's widely offered. Is there a way that you could describe for us an impact it's making?
I get letters and emails from people from around the world saying how much they appreciate it. And, of course, invitations to speak at conferences. And according to my publisher, it's one of their best sellers.
Oh, well.
Of course, it hasn't made the New York Times list yet.
No. But... The New York Times list probably won't have
lots of things
much
on it.
Sway when we get to see the Lord face to face. He won't say, well, Mr. Nickel, your book never made the New York Times bestseller list. But it's gotten you an invitation to the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship.
I appreciate it.
And you've spoken. Where have you spoken?
I have spoken in Australia, in New Zealand, all over America, from West Coast to East Coast. I've even spoken in South America.
You knew Ken Ham in Australia.
I knew Ken Ham in Australia.
Ken Ham has been in our studio on a couple of occasions. Mm-hmm. And we enjoy interviewing scientists and creation authors and speakers from all the major ministries. It's such a joy. We have just a few more minutes, so I'd like to know, is there something you'd like to add to our conversation?
Just that there is power in the biblical Christian worldview in a relationship to God the Creator revealed in Jesus Christ. When I was trained in my university experience and I got my degree in mathematics, I left university saying this to myself, I never again do I want to open up another math book. Mm. That's a sorry statement.
Mm.
But God directed me towards several people who showed me that God applies to the whole of life. And then I says, well, then, if that's true, then does he apply to mathematics? And so one professor told me, that's your job to figure that out.
Hmm.
He didn't really have an answer to it. That's back in 1978 when that happened.
Wow.
And so then began a research trail to find out.
Where were you studying? Where was this professor?
Oh, I was teaching at a school, and this professor is a professor at Indiana Wesleyan University who came over to speak on education. So I was actually teaching at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he challenged me to do that. You'll see it, the book Mathematics is God Silent. He does the foreword. He really encouraged me to research, figure it out, and understand presuppositions, the nature of knowledge, nature of ethics, nature of reality. Mm-hmm. Those are foundational issues that justify doing math and doing science. And only the biblical Christian worldview can justify it properly.
Have you seen Jason Lyle's book, The Ultimate Proof of Creation? presuppositionalism, basically Van Til, and the prerequisites, the preconditions of intelligibility.
Right. That's what I would adhere to, yes.
And so that entire argument is so powerful in that the atheist cannot justify even his use of logic.
Correct.
He claims that he has a strictly logical worldview, and we ask, well, how do you know, how do you validate the laws of logic?
Correct.
And they have a very hard time. And they'll say, well, they work. Well, we all know that they work. We agree with that.
Correct.
I mean, not all know, but most of us agree with that. They work. But how do you validate that? How do you know? How do you justify the fact that they work if there's just material, just a material universe, naturalism?
Yes.
That's where their worldview crumbles. That's one place it crumbles.
Right.
And that's at the foundation.
And that's where you have to start, at the foundation. Unless you have the foundation, if that's not built properly, what you build on is going to be shaky.
Yeah, and Jesus told us this. If you build on sand, then you're not going to be able to withstand the reality of life and existence.
Right.
So the foundation is him. It seems that atheists, a long time ago, they started to deny the existence of right and wrong. They said it's all relative. In American popular culture, that was many decades ago. Now, they're increasingly denying that truth exists, even truth. It seems that as soon as they acknowledge that there is truth, they intuitively recognize they're pointing to a God of truth. That's what's stopping them.
Right.
The curator of the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, his name is Dr. Kirk Johnston. We had a group going through the museum, about maybe 75 of us. So he was tagging along, and there was a reporter who also joined us. And at one point, I pointed out to him that one of their exhibits had something that was not true. It's blatantly not true. And he said, he sounded like Pilate. He said, what is truth? So I asked him, well, do you believe truth exists? And he said, I don't know. Maybe not. And I said, well, do you exist? And he said, I don't know, in front of our group, in front of the reporter. Because if he admits he exists, then that's a bit of truth. We have common ground. We
Correct.
Can go from there.
Yes.
He's afraid to admit that he exists as a matter of fact.
Right.
And yet he's determined to say Darwinism is true when he doesn't know if he exists.
Right.
It seems that that's an intellectual tantrum.
Yes.
And these
it's
are
schizophrenia.
Adults.
Yes.
It's a schizophrenic worldview.
Yeah.
Well, James Nickel, it's an honor to speak with you tonight. I'd like to invite people who are within driving distance of Denver to come on out to hear Mr. Nickel in his talk, Why Mathematics Works. That is at the Bethlehem Lutheran Chapel at 21st and Wadsworth. It's actually in Lakewood. Kids are welcome. Homeschool kids do so very well on standardized tests. Your kids, bring them on out. They should be able to understand a good chunk of what's presented.
Correct.
Last month, we had a speaker on barometrology. It was amazing how many kids continued asking questions afterward.
Right.
So kids are brilliant. They're made in God's image and likeness. So I want to thank you, James Nickel. Thank you for writing your book, for your testimony for the Lord, and for coming to Denver.
Thank you for having me.
All right. What a joy. And it's a fascinating topic. Mathematics, is God silent? So please come on out. And if you'd like to share this, you could do so online at kgov.com.
Would you like to study the Bible, but don't really know where to start? Bob Enyart's seminar on hermeneutics, tools for studying the Bible, will help you to study and understand the Bible on a whole new level. Hermeneutics, tools for studying the Bible, is available by calling 1-800-8-ENYART, or you can get the MP3 CD or the MP3 download at kgovstore.com. That's kgovstore.com.